All right, let's start the second chapter of the unit, which is a tour of the cell. We're going to survey the major parts of cells, most of which are organelles. But before we look at that, the opening slide just shows you where we are in the scale of things size-wise. When we're talking about a cell, there is a range of sizes cells can have. There are really small ones comparatively and really big ones comparatively, but the overall range of cell size is not really all that huge. All cells, I mean, the vast majority of cells, not all cells, are very close in size to each other. And notice that this is a logarithmic scale, by the way, so each step is 10 times bigger than the other, just like pH. But this yellow range is where cells, the sizes of cells, all fall into. And that's just below the ability of the human eye to see, which is why we need light microscopy to view them, at least light microscopy. And that's really all you can view with light microscopy is cells, and you get a little bit of ability to see subcellular structures like a nucleus, for instance. But if you want to actually see molecular detail, I mean very fine detail like you see the photomicrographs in textbooks of organelles themselves, that requires a lot more resolution, which you get with electron microscopy. All right, let's go to 2 now and start talking about cells in general. Do you remember what I said the dichotomy is with respect to cell type? Yeah, a dichotomy is a two-part way of looking at something. So there are two major types of cells. That's right. Eukaryotic cells are named for the fact that they have a true nucleus. That's really not the only thing that distinguishes them from prokaryotic cells, but that's the basis for the etymology. We're not looking at a eukaryotic cell here. We're looking at a prokaryotic cell. And remember, the pro part means before, which is a good reminder that evolutionarily, prokaryotic cells were the first cells. They are by far the most successful organisms. Not only were they the first, but they still vastly outnumber everything else. We don't see them because they're microscopically small, but they're there. In fact, your body is the cells that you call your own, the cells that make up your body that have your own DNA, which there's about 100 trillion of, are vastly outnumbered by prokaryotic cells that live in and on you. There's 10 to 100 times as many prokaryotic cells on and in you than there are your own cells. So they're very successful. They were the first to appear, and they're still successful, but they don't have a nucleus. They don't have a membrane-bounded chamber called the nucleus that separates that interior, the cytoplasm, into compartments. There is only one compartment in a prokaryotic cell. And all of that stuff collectively is called the cytoplasm. This is just a typical prokaryotic cell. It's not that every prokaryotic cell is going to look like this. There are different shapes, for instance. This is a bacterium. And keep in mind that though there is a dichotomy with respect to cell types, there are two different domains. Two of the three domains of life contain the prokaryotic cell, the prokaryotic organisms. Bacteria are their own domain, archaea are their own domain, but they are both prokaryotic cells. So not every prokaryote is a bacterium is what I'm saying, but all bacteria are prokaryotes. Well, there is no nucleus, which is where in a eukaryotic cell you find the DNA, but not having a nucleus doesn't mean that a prokaryotic cell doesn't have DNA. It wouldn't be able to live without DNA because it needs DNA for exactly the same reason that eukaryotic cells do. And since it's not in its own compartment, the the prokaryotic DNA is just part of the cytoplasm. Even though it is just part of the one compartment they have, the cytoplasm, the DNA is not completely diffused throughout the entire space. It's kind of aggregated or separated from the rest, even though there's no membrane. And that region that we find the DNA is called the nucleoid, which means like a nucleus without actually being a nucleus. There are ribosomes that you see here in brown. There are these little brown dots are ribosomes. Ribosomes are organelles, and we'll talk more about ribosomes as we get to the rest of the chapter. But they are not membrane-bounded organelles, which is why it shouldn't surprise you that you find them in prokaryotes. Prokaryotic cells not only don't have a nucleus, which is one example of a membrane-bounded organelle, they also don't have other membrane-bounded organelles. Only eukaryotic cells do. Well, the ribosome is an organelle, which is like a little organ within the cell, but it does not feature its own membrane. So it's not a membrane-bounded organelle. The flagella that you see on this figure aren't on every cell. This is kind of a catch-all picture. Not every bacterium or any other prokaryote is going to be flagellated or have flagella. But if they are there, flagella are locomotory devices. They're structures for the purpose of locomotion, which means movement from point A to point B, movement through the fluid in which the cell lives. The shorter appendages, these little hair-like appendages, are called fimbriae. The singular is fimbria. And they can be, they're not necessarily there either, it depends on the species, but fimbriae, if there are there, can greatly facilitate the cell sticking to some surface, like your tonsil, for instance, or whatever it lives on. So they might be there, they might not. Now, every cell by definition, not just prokaryotic cells, every cell has a plasma membrane. That is the membrane that defines the cell because it separates the contents of the cell, which is its own little chamber, from everything else, the rest of the universe. This is what makes little cells little test tubes, as I talked about in that first week, in which the chemistry of life, metabolism, can occur in isolation from the surroundings. So every cell has a plasma membrane, including prokaryotic cells, but typically a prokaryotic cell will have a cell wall exterior to that. Just like we were talking about plants having cell walls. That's made differently. It's made of different stuff, but it's a cell wall. And so that cell wall is much tougher. It holds pressure, just like in a plant cell. And sometimes external to the cell wall, you have what's called a capsule, which includes molecules that will help them stick to surfaces as well. Okay, that's just a quick rundown of a prokaryotic cell. In slide 3, we're looking at a close-up in cartoon form here of just a little piece of this real photograph, a photomicrograph, of showing a cross-sectional view of the membrane itself. This is the interior of the cell. This is the plasma membrane. And we can see on the photomicrograph that we're not just making up this story about phospholipids forming a bilayer. You can see the two layers here. So the phospholipid bilayer forms for the reason I told you before. Why is that? What causes the phospholipid bilayer to form the way it does? Right, and what is the word that means both hydrophobic and hydrophilic within the same molecule? Close. Amphipathic.
There you go.
Amphipathic. phospholipids are amphipathic, and therefore they will self-assemble into two monolayers, or one bilayer, in which the tails, which are hydrophobic, of one phospholipid monolayer are facing the tails of the other phospholipid monolayer, so that those hydrophobic tails can avoid water, which is what they are afraid of, according to the word, which is because they don't want to be around the polar water. The heads are in direct contact with the water, either exteriorly or interiorly, which is just fine with them because the heads include the phosphate group, which makes them charged. They don't mind being around polar things. Now, when I showed you that bilayer picture in the previous chapter, that was nothing but a pure phospholipid bilayer, which you would get if you just put nothing but phospholipids into pure water. There would be nothing alive there. It would just form a little bag. A complete plasma membrane is more than just a phospholipid bilayer, and there are proteins, for instance, among other things, but proteins are important other components of the plasma membrane that are there for various reasons we're going to get into. Okay, now to four. I said at the first slide that cells really are all kind of the same size. There's not much range in size, at least as far as all three dimensions are concerned. Now, you started out as a typically sized single cell, right? The zygote. That was, even though that wasn't the beginning of you, it's the official beginning of you, but really it's a continuation, a 3.5 billion year continuation of cells creating new cells until your zygote was created. But anyway, you started as a zygote, microscopically small. Now you are macroscopically big. And you didn't get the size you are just by having your one zygote cell become huge. And that's because it's not possible for a living cell to get big indefinitely in all three dimensions. Now, there are some cells that are very big in one dimension but still tiny in the other, like a neuron, for instance. It goes all the way from toe to spinal cord. It's a very long cell, but width-wise and depth-wise, it is still microscopically small. You can't get a cell that long plus that wide plus that deep. It would be impossible to grow in all three dimensions. And this slide attempts to explain why. There is a constraint or a limit put on how big cells can get in all three dimensions. And that constraint is called the surface-to-volume ratio, which, like any ratio in math, is really just a fraction, right? One number divided by another number. The surface area, let's use these cubes as examples. Now, some cells are kind of cube-shaped, not perfect, of course. Most cells are more spherical, but if we think of them as cubes, it's simply easier to think of the math. You could do the math in any case, but cubes are easier to work with. All right, so you have this cell, which is one unit, one cubic unit big. It's one by one by one. And there's no units given here because the units don't really matter. But we're starting with a one by one by one cell. Okay? It's a cube, so what is its surface area? I mean, how do you compute its surface area? Well, the surface area is the area of one of its sides, right, which is 1 times 1, because the surface area is length times width. But there are 6 of those faces. Each face is 1 by 1, so it's times 6. And that's why you get the 6 unit here. So it would, if you had units, it would be 6 square units of surface area, like centimeters squared, for instance. The volume, on the other hand, is 1 times 1 times 1, length times width times height. So it has a volume of 1 cubic unit, or 1 unit cubed. All right, that's all clear? Therefore, the surface-to-volume ratio is the first divided by the second. 6 divided by 1, which is 6. All right? That's the value for its surface area to volume ratio. That's the cell before we allow it to grow. Now, if we let this thing get 5 times as big in all 3 dimensions at the same time, 5 times as wide, 5 times as tall, and 5 times as deep, you have this bigger cube, right? Each of its faces is now 5 by 5, 25 square units on each face times 6. That's where the 150 comes from, 150 square units of surface area. The volume is 5 times 5 times 5, right? Which is 125. So now this bigger cell has a surface area to volume ratio, 150 divided by 125, of only 1.2. So as a cell grows in all 3 dimensions, the surface area to volume ratio goes down. And mathematically, that makes sense, because area is a square function and volume is a cubic function. So if you graph y equals x squared for the positive x's, it's going to look like this, right? Y equals x cubed is steeper. It gets big quicker. All right? So the reason that the surface area to volume ratio goes down is because when a cell grows in all 3 dimensions, both the surface area and the volume get bigger, but volume gets bigger quicker than surface area gets bigger. In other words, volume is outgrowing surface area as a cell grows. And the reason that this is a constraint on how big a cell can be is that in order for a cell to remain alive, it has to continuously be exchanging materials and energy with the surroundings. Things have to be taken into the cell, things have to be taken out of the cell for it to remain alive. Well, where does that exchange take place for any given cell? At the surface, the boundary between the cell and everything else. It's where the exchange has to take place. So if a cell gets big in all 3 dimensions, that volume that's increasing within it means that larger volume is going to require more and more transport of materials in and out. But even though the surface area is getting bigger, it's not keeping pace with the volume. And therefore, you run out of surface area, enough surface area to be able to put things in and out fast enough to keep it alive. That's why organisms that get big, like us, and there's plenty of things bigger than us, of course, do not get big by growing the cell indefinitely. Instead, they get big by being multicellular, by making their big body out of a bunch of cells that are small, just like unicellular organisms are. So this multicellular organism, represented by the collection of cubes here, has an overall body the same as this impossibly big 5x5x5 cell. But by having it as individual cells, each individual cell still has a surface area to volume ratio of 6. Now, this is, by analogy with food, this would be like a potato, which if you want to make hash browns, you don't throw a whole potato into the skillet, right? You're not going to get much browning because there's not much surface area. But if you cut it into cubes, I guess it would be home fries, not hash browns. But anyway, you cut it into cubes, you're drastically increasing the surface of the potato that can be exposed to the oil and get brown. Okay, that's surface area to volume ratio. Now we can go to slide 5, where it's going to seem like we're stuck for a while. Not all of the slides are going to take this long. We can breeze through them comparatively after this, but it takes a while to get through this because I want to describe each of these parts. This is not only a cell, but More specifically, it's a eukaryotic cell. I shouldn't have to tell you that because you can see clearly that it has a nucleus, right? And even more specifically than saying it's a eukaryotic cell, this is an animal cell, like your own. It's also a catch-all picture, though. So it's not that any given animal cell looks like this necessarily. Well, first of all, the coloration is artificial, obviously. But this is just a picture drawn to show you all the possible things that an animal cell can include. Not every animal cell is going to have every one of these structures. But let's start with the nucleus, which is really an important structure, of course, that defines eukaryotic cells. The nucleus is not only an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. And remember, do you remember what I said about the difference between membrane-bound and membrane-bounded? Some of you are saying yes. Just nodding to get me to go. Keep going. What is the difference between the phrases membrane-bounded and membrane-bound? Yeah.
One has a membrane around it, the other one is bound to the membrane.
Yeah, so which one has the membrane around it?
Membrane bounded.
Right. Membrane bounded could also be called membrane enclosed. It's bounded by its own membrane or enclosed by its own membrane. That's what I mean by membrane bounded organelle. And the nucleus is certainly not, I mean, certainly an example of that, but even more specifically, it is the first of three examples I'm going to give you of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle, meaning this organelle has more than one membrane around it. And you can kind of see this. You'll see a better view later. Depending on where you're sitting, you might see that there's two layers of membrane here. Now, I'm not talking about the two monolayers of a phospholipid bilayer. When I'm talking about membrane here, which is the subcellular sense of the word membrane, like your skin is a membrane, but that's many cells thick. I'm talking about a membrane of a cell. That one membrane is two layers already, right? Because it's two phospholipid layers. The two layers I'm talking about here is two separate bilayers. So it's just like two membranes, just like two plasma membranes, only it's double thickness. What's that?
So it's a quad layer bilayer.
If you count the monolayers, yes, it would be four monolayers. And these two membranes that make up or that enclose the nucleus are pretty reasonably named. They are called the outer membrane and the inner membrane. I'll leave it to you to figure out which is which. But together, both of them are collectively called the nuclear envelope. So the nuclear envelope is two membranes thick. Now, every once in a while, in a kind of a pinkish color, you see that the nuclear envelope is perforated or filled with holes. Each hole here is really a complex of proteins that are embedded in that nuclear envelope, but the proteins are arranged kind of like the staves of a barrel with a hollow interior. And so that's what makes them pores. Nuclear pores, they're called, which are really important for reasons we'll look at pictures of later. But for now, I'll just tell you that things have to get through the nuclear envelope, and the nuclear pores allow that. Inside the nucleus, you already know there is DNA, but that's not the only thing that's in there. All of the stuff collectively inside the nucleus is called nucleoplasm. It's not cytoplasm. A eukaryotic cell has cytoplasm, but remember that unlike prokaryotic cells, eukaryotic cells are compartmentalized because of their membrane-bounded organelles. So there are subcompartments within the overall cellular compartment. For a prokaryotic cell, the cytoplasm is everything in that one compartment. For a eukaryotic cell, the cytoplasm is collectively the stuff that's inside the cell, but outside of the membrane-bounded organelles, including the nucleus. And therefore, the stuff inside the nucleus gets its own name, which is nucleoplasm, stuff of the nucleus, literally. That includes DNA, but also it includes a bunch of proteins that are complexed with that DNA, as we'll further investigate later. And that combination of DNA, which is nucleic acid, and protein is called chromatin. That's where this word comes from. All right? Now look at the word nucleolus. Be careful with that because it is so similar to nucleus. The nucleolus is just part of the nucleus. It's a region within the nucleus. This dark region is the nucleolus. And that's a place where RNA other than messenger RNA, which we'll talk about more later, there's many different kinds of RNA, but RNA other than messenger RNA is produced at the nucleolus. The rest of the chromatin, which is the rest of the DNA as well, is used to make mRNA, a specific kind of RNA. All right, now, I don't know how much you can see from where you're sitting on this either, but we'll get a closer view later. Notice, though, if you can, that the outer nuclear membrane, every once in a while, turns outward, and in this picture, turns from purple to blue. The coloration is artificial, just so you can see the boundaries of the individual organelles. So the purple stuff is officially nucleus. But notice that this membrane turns here, folds outward, and so it's continuous. It's still the same piece of membrane, but it officially becomes part of a different organelle when it's blue here. And all of this stuff in blue is its own membrane-bounded organelle, collectively called the endoplasmic reticulum. The endoplasmic reticulum itself is, even though it's one organelle officially, exists as two parts. There are two parts that you can tell structurally from each other because they look different, but they also have different functions. Notice this is still blue, like this is blue, but this blue part looks more like a net than a system of flattened sacs like the rest of it. The net part is called the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, just part of the overall ER, or endoplasmic reticulum. And then the flattened sacs, collectively, are called the rough endoplasmic reticulum. What gives the rough ER its roughness in appearance is the fact that it has connected to the surface of the membrane all of these brown dots that you see in the figure. Just like brown dots before for the prokaryotic example, these brown dots represent ribosomes. Ribosomes are their own organelles, so each brown dot is an organelle. But they are not membrane-bounded organelles. They are just a complex of proteins and RNA that we'll look at later. Little molecular machines, basically, that are, these ones happen to be, at the moment, connected to the membrane of the ER. That's what makes the appearance look rough when you look at it under a microscope. That's why it was named that. The smooth ER doesn't have these ribosomes associated with it. And it's also more tubular in appearance, the smooth is. So that's the two structural differences between the two parts. There's also functional differences. These two parts do different things. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum is important for production of lipids within the cell. That's where lipids get produced. And it's another function, that's not the only function, is to produce lipids. That's a major one. Another function, though, is to store certain things, like, for instance, calcium ions. Calcium ions can be sequestered or stored away from the rest of the cell in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. This is a big function in your muscle cells, for instance, because calcium is an important signal that allows for muscular contraction. You don't want those calcium ions to be released where they'll do the job of contracting unless you really want the muscle to contract. So until that happens, they're safely stored in the endoplasmic reticulum. Okay, the rough ER's job, main job, is to modify newly made polypeptides. We just got done talking about polypeptides in the previous chapter and the fact that they are built one amino acid at a time, and then they have to attain their correct shape, for one thing, if they're ever going to function. But also some of the polypeptides need to actually be modified chemically before they can do their job. Like things added to them other than amino acids, for instance, or some amino acids being cleaved off. There's all kinds of modifications that might have to take place depending on the protein. Those modifications occur in the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And this explains, we'll see the details later, this explains the roughness. The roughness is the ribosomes. The job of ribosomes is to manufacture those polypeptides. So as they're being built, these strings of beads, these polypeptides, are being put into the hollow interior. The word for hollow interior is lumen, of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. These brand new polypeptides are being put right into the organelle that is responsible for modifying them if they need modification. It is efficient. Okay, so that's another organelle, the ER overall. That's the blue stuff. Now, if they didn't have the colorization here, you might confuse this teal-colored one with just more ER. But this is not. It also looks like flattened sacs, which it basically is. But it's its own organelle called either the Golgi apparatus, some books will call it that, or the Golgi, just by itself sometimes they call it. Golgi is just the name of a dead Italian who's honored by naming it that. But the Golgi, or some books will call it the Golgi complex, they all refer to the same thing. The Golgi apparatus, though, is, functionally speaking, more or less a receiving and shipping center. So I just got done telling you that the rough endoplasmic reticulum, the blue stuff, functions for modification of newly made polypeptides, right? Those then modified polypeptides, once the rough ER does its job, get packaged into little bags of membrane called vesicles and sent to the nearby Golgi complex. So that's the receiving aspect. It's like trucks going to the receiving lot of a factory, right? Delivering things to the factory. The Golgi receives those packages of polypeptides, and then it figures out where they need to go. And it packages them in new vesicles and sends those vesicles on their way. You can see vesicle right here, this little blue circle, is a vesicle that budded off of the organelle itself. So when we're talking about the membrane of any of these membrane-bounded organelles, it's all the same stuff, really. It's all phospholipid bilayer with other things mixed in there. And it doesn't, a piece of membrane does not stay permanently with an organelle. The rough ER buds off a little piece of itself to form a vesicle to send that vesicle to the Golgi. And then when that membrane material meets the membrane material of the Golgi, since it's made of the same stuff, it will basically just coalesce or melt right into it. Kind of like when you see a small drop of oil and a big drop of oil floating on water, and when they hit each other, they just join. That's what membrane material does. So membrane material moves around from organelle to organelle continuously. All right, that's the Golgi. Now, next, if we keep going clockwise, is the lysosome that you see here in pinkish. Now, the lysosome looks like a vesicle, and technically it is, but it's a vesicle that has a very specific function, so it's considered its own organelle and given its own name. What does the lyso part of the name mean? Split. And some, or soma, means body. So this is linguistically a splitting body. It's so called, it's called that because its job is to contain hydrolytic enzymes. Hydrolytic is just the adjective of hydrolysis. So enzymes that speed up hydrolysis reactions are hydrolytic enzymes. And hydrolytic enzymes, which you know, that split things apart, that's what hydrolysis is, right? Those are dangerous things to have around in the cell. Because a hydrolytic enzyme can split apart things in the cell that you don't want split apart. So lysosomes keep them away from the rest of the cell. And only things that you put into the lysosome are then exposed to those dangerous hydrolytic enzymes, and you end up splitting the things that you do want that way, do want to be split. Okay, next up is the mitochondrion that you see here in yellow. There's two of them shown here, but there's nothing saying that it has to be two. These bean-shaped organelles are called mitochondria. That's the plural. Mitochondrion is the singular, so this is just one mitochondrion. And the mitochondrion is the second of three multiply membrane-bounded organelles. The nucleus was the first one. A mitochondrion also has two membranes, and they're also called outer and inner membrane of the mitochondrion. You can see that detail even on this small scale one, right? There's an outer membrane that is a smooth membrane as big as it needs to be to hold everything in it. The inner membrane is actually bigger than the outer membrane because it is folded many times. And we'll talk about that later when we see a closer view. And we'll study it in greater detail in a different unit. For now, though, I'll just tell you that the major job of the mitochondrion is a complex set of reactions that we'll study later called cellular respiration, which is an important part of energy processing within eukaryotic cells. Okay, the next one up is a peroxisome. Looks very similar to a lysosome, right? Wouldn't be able to tell them apart without the coloring, which is artificial. But the peroxisome has a slightly different job, kind of similar to a lysosome, but it's handling a different job. As part of normal metabolism, a cell produces byproducts, and some of those byproducts are potentially harmful, including things that are called reactive oxygen species, or just ROS. reactive oxygen species are harmful because they can cause oxidation of other materials. They're unstable oxygen-containing compounds that can grab electrons from other things, which is means it can oxidize other things, and that can destroy those things. This is why you see in nutrition news people talking about antioxidants. Antioxidants are things that try to deal with this problem as well. But we have built-in things called peroxisomes to deal with this. Peroxide is just one example of a reactive oxygen species. And that's why we call these things peroxisomes. Peroxide-dealing bodies, basically, is what it means. So they have enzymes in them to deal with these ROS and convert them into safer things. All right, microvilli. Microvilli is the plural, by the way, of microvillus, U-S ending. Villus, by itself, is a word that means a finger-like projection. And so there are villi in different places in the body. For instance, your tongue has villi. When you look at it close up, the little bumps are villi. A microvillus is therefore just a microscopically small finger-like projection. So these microvilli that we see here, that's a good example of what I was saying earlier. Not every cell is going to have these, but some of them do. I'll give you an example in a minute. But these microvilli are not organelles. They are just arrangements of the plasma membrane in a certain place. So this is all plasma membrane, this outer covering, right? This yellow. And here you don't have microvilli. It's just a smooth membrane. But where the microvilli start, notice that it's all made out of plasma membrane. It's just the plasma membrane is folded out back and forth to form these little finger-like projections. Now, why would a cell do that? Why not just have it smooth everywhere? What does forming these microvilli accomplish? Well, it drastically increases the surface area. Right? Because membrane is surface. I can give you an analogy in two dimensions. If you imagine that this cell is an island, and the plasma membrane, which has been cut away here, you're looking at it on edge. The edge of the plasma membrane here is like the beach. Right, if you have to get from here to here, on this smooth part, it's a straight shot. Just walk straight down the beach from A to B, right? But over here, if you have to get from A to B, which is the same distance as the crow flies, but you have to walk along the beach to do it, you're going to have to walk a lot farther, right? There's a lot more beach. There's a lot more membrane involved when you have microvilli without actually adding a bunch of volume, because between each microvillus is outside of the cell. So you don't really mess with volume much, but you drastically increase surface area. And this is important sometimes. This is why not all cells have it. It's important when you need membrane for a purpose. Typically, that's because you need things that are embedded in the membrane to do their jobs for you. A good example in your body is the endothelium, the inner lining of your small intestine, which is part of your alimentary canal or digestive tract, but it's the part that is most responsible for absorbing the nutrients that have become small enough because of digestion while it was still outside of your body, finally bringing those into your body. We don't put food into our body. We say we do all the time, but we don't. We put food into a tube, a continuous tube called the alimentary canal that runs from mouth to anus. It takes twists and turns, but it's all one tube, right? And that is outside of your body. I didn't just stick my finger into my body. I put it, it's still in the air. Right? And so our body is wrapped around that tube. The tube is not inside our body. Just like the hole of a donut is not, you can put your finger through it, you're not sticking your finger through the donut. So we put food into that tube, and it's made of big molecules, the macromolecules we just got done talking about, that are way too big to get into the cells through their membranes. That's why first, before absorption, the digestive system has to chemically digest those macromolecules using hydrolysis reactions while it's still outside your body into small enough pieces, the monomers that these things are made out of, so that they can then be transported into the cell. Transporting it into the cell is the absorption that I'm talking about, but doing that means bringing it through plasma membranes to get them into those cells, and that involves the help of a bunch of membrane-bound proteins, proteins that are part of the membrane, that help in that transport process. And the more membrane you have, the more proteins you can embed in that, and therefore the more you can absorb in the short amount of time that you have while this stuff is passing through the tube before it's wasted. All right, so it allows for efficient absorption. There's other reasons why you would want to increase surface area, but that's just a good example from your body. That's what microvilli do, though. All right, now, next we have one all caps structure called the cytoskeleton. The cytoskeleton is kind of, I mean, the name is good because it literally means cell skeleton. Cyto means cell. It's like our overall bony skeleton to our body, only it's a skeleton for the individual cell. It doesn't mean that it's hard stuff like our endoskeletal bones are, but it's a framework. And also, just like our overall bony skeleton, it is not put into place and then permanent. Your bones are continuously changing moment to moment internally. They're being rebuilt, they're being torn down and rebuilt all the time. You're just not aware of it. The cytoskeleton is not just a passive set of structures that are put there once and then ignored. It's a dynamic system. Dynamic means changing, opposite of static. Well, structurally, as you can see here, the cytoskeleton overall is made up of three major kinds of proteins. And those are what are listed here. Microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. All three combined make up the overall cytoskeleton. And microtubules are the ones that are in yellow here. Microtubules are important as for two major reasons. They serve as little roadways for one thing, which is why you see them crossing all directions through the cell. Microtubules are roadways in the sense that, just like roadways in a city, they allow things to be transported from one place to another along those roadways. So as we'll see in a different picture, there are little proteins called motor proteins that walk along these microtubules, carrying things along the way. But another reason that the microtubules are really important is that they form what's called the mitotic spindle when it comes time for this animal cell to split into two new cells. And we'll look at that detail later as well, but that involves microtubules. Intermediate filaments and microfilaments, also important, but we'll look at those in individual detail in a different picture. It's all part of the cytoskeleton, though. This centrosome that we see labeled is a little bit confusing. The centrosome is not this T-shaped yellow thing. The centrosome is this yellow kind of halo around the T-shaped thing that contains the T-shaped thing, but it's not the T-shaped thing. Okay, so this yellow region here is the centrosome. And the centrosome is a microtubule organizing center. Microtubules are manufactured starting at the centrosome, and they get longer and grow out from there. As we'll see when we look at the plant cell in the next slide, plants also have centrosomes. But unlike plants, animal cells have this T-shaped thing, which is really two pieces, the two pieces of the T. Plants don't have these. These parts of the T, each one looks kind of like a piece of licorice, are called centrioles. So the centrioles make up the T-shaped structure that are in the centrosome in animal cells. And that's their name. I wish I could tell you their function, but we haven't figured it out yet. As a matter of fact, well, so the centrosome is really important in the process of cell division, mitosis. So since the centrioles are part of the centrosome, it's reasonable to expect that they are somehow involved in this. But we've actually experimentally taken the centrioles out of animal centrosomes, and it doesn't seem to affect their ability to divide. So they can do without it. And plants don't have them to begin with, and they divide, no problem. So it's reasonable to expect that they are there for some reason. Otherwise, natural selection would have favored not having them. But we just, it's one of the things we don't know. All right, this animal cell happens to be flagellated, which some are. This is another example of something that's not necessarily there, depending on what kind of cell you're looking at. What's an example, for instance, in humans as an animal of a cell that's flagellated?
Sperm.
Yeah, sperm are flagellated cells because sperm have to make a very long journey in terms of their body length if they're going to do their job of delivering the DNA that they contain to an egg to form the zygote in fertilization. So it's just like it was for a bacterium. A flagellum, if it's there in an animal cell, is a locomotory device. It's there for propelling the cell through the medium. Okay, I think I made it all the way around. Now we can finally switch slides, go to 6, which looks pretty much similar to the previous slide, but this is a plant cell, not an animal cell. And I don't want you to have the idea that every organism is either a bacterium, an animal, or a plant. There are other kinds of organisms, but animals and plants we're comparing because they're two major and important types of eukaryotic organisms. Fungi are important too, but we're just not going through them in this slideshow. But this is a plant cell, and you should notice that a plant cell contains a bunch of the things that we just talked about occurring in animal cells. So it's not going to take me as long to go through this because the things that plant cells have that animal cells also have the same function in plant cells as they do in animal cells, including the nucleus, for instance, and the endoplasmic reticulum and so on. So I'll focus on things that plant cells have that animal cells don't. One conspicuous thing is this huge, seemingly empty structure called the central vacuole. I say seemingly empty because it's not empty. It's not space in there. It's filled with fluid. But this seeming emptiness is why it's called a vacuole. It's vacuous, which means empty. A vacuum is emptiness. So it's a misnomer, really. It's not really empty. It's mostly water that's in there. But it can be other things as well. The central vacuole, depending on the cell, can do different things, including acting more or less like a trash dump. things that the plant cell wants to get out of the cytoplasm, away from the other stuff, can put it into the central vacuole. But also, you sometimes see pigment molecules in here. In the lab later, we'll look at onion root tip cells. Cells from the purple part of an onion. When you look at them individual cells, it's not the entire cell that's purple. That pigment molecule is in the central vacuole. So that's another example of a function. Central vacuoles, though, mostly water, as I said. And this is one reason why plants can grow much more quickly than animals. You know, you've probably witnessed this with seedlings. Just in one day, you can see that a seedling has gotten much longer. The stem has gotten a lot longer. Well, that's a hell of a lot of cells that have been added just overnight. But one reason that it can be so fast is that a lot of the interior, notice how much of the overall volume of the cell is occupied by the central vacuole. A lot of that is just water. And plants don't make water. They just take it in. They imbibe it from the surroundings. So it's already water to begin with. They don't have to spend time and energy to make it. And since that's a big fraction of their volume, they can grow pretty quickly. Another thing that we did not see in animal cells, but we can see in plant cells, and there's typically about 50, not just 3 as seen here, are these green organelles, which are the third example of multiply membrane-bounded organelles. So we had the nucleus, the mitochondrion, and now the chloroplast. Chloroplasts are not found in animal cells because animals ecologically are examples of what we call consumers. Have I given you the two terms, producers and consumers, yet? Only producers can make food. And consumers have to rely on that. They have to either eat other consumers or eat producers directly. Well, food is produced in chloroplasts, which plants have, but also other organisms. Plants are not the only photosynthetic organisms, and they did not invent photosynthesis. Like all important biochemical pathways, it happened first in bacteria. Bacteria were the first photosynthetic organisms. Now, maybe you've already figured out what I'm about to say. Bacteria are prokaryotic, right? So they can't have chloroplasts because chloroplasts are membrane-bounded organelles. Photosynthesis occurred in a prokaryote first, and they perform photosynthesis very similar to how a chloroplast does it, but they do it without having their own membrane-bounded organelles. They do it with their single plasma membrane that they have by folding it back and forth, so it's kind of the same as having membrane-bounded organelles without actually officially having separate membranes. But a chloroplast, functionally speaking, for now, we'll look at the details later, is the organelle of photosynthesis. Whereas mitochondrion, as I said, is the organelle of cellular respiration. Well, animals have mitochondria. They perform cellular respiration, which is what gets them most of the energy that comes from food. Notice plants also do, though. Plants have photosynthetic organelles, chloroplasts. They also have the organelles of cellular respiration, mitochondria. And that's where they use the food. They produce the food in the chloroplast, and they're not producing it for us, right? They're producing it for themselves. Well, the food gets used for energy in the mitochondria, just like it does in our own mitochondria, but we eat the food rather than making it ourselves. All right, now, the big, thick brown layers that we're looking at here are the cell wall. We've already talked about that in lab and earlier today. Plant cells have cell walls in addition to their plasma membranes. Never lose track of the fact that any cell has to have a plasma membrane or it's not a cell. But in this figure, the thin yellow layer is the plasma membrane, which is why I was, maybe I didn't tell you, but it's kind of like the paint of the wall. The structure of the wall is like the cell wall. The plasma membrane is like paint, so it's thin. The much thicker brown cell wall is there to hold in the pressure, as we've talked about. But notice in this view of the cell wall, and over here as well, you can see these little yellow tunnels. They are examples of what are called, in general, intercellular junctions, which just means junctions between cells, intercellular, right? They're passageways so that something can travel from one cell to the next cell. So they literally are little tunnels, and you can see that in this cutaway view right here. But specifically, when these are occurring in plants, we call them plasmodesmata, which is a plural. Notice it's pointing to two. The singular is just plasmodesma, without the TA. And interestingly, at least to me, is that because of these plasmodesmata, the cytoplasm of a plant cell is continuous with the cytoplasm of all the cells around it. And so really in a huge plant, even in a huge plant, like a tree, there is one big cytoplasm, even though there are quadrillions of cells, right? Because things can, if you're the right kind of particle, you can get through these tunnels and go from one cell to the other without actually going through any membranes. And that's because the lining of the tunnel is really just an extension of the plasma membrane, which will then become the plasma membrane of the next cell. I have not talked about, well, I guess I have talked about all of that. Okay, so that's the plant cell. Let's then go to close-up views, which we can get through more quickly per slide. Slide 7 gives you a little bit better view of not just one organelle. There's two here, which is why there are the two colors. But you can see the nucleus and the rough endoplasmic reticulum that surrounds it. Now you can get a better view of what I was saying before. The membrane that makes up the rough endoplasmic reticulum is really just an extension here and there of the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope. It's all the same material. And it's really not purple and blue. That's just for convenience. You also get a nice close-up cartoon picture of these nuclear pores. Each pore is a complex of proteins arranged in a circle with a hollow interior. And I said that things have to get through there. Chief among those things that need to get through the nuclear pores are messenger RNA molecules, which are produced in the nucleus because that's where the DNA is. Remember I told you before that DNA codes for how to make an mRNA. That means the mRNA that's produced is now in the nucleus where the DNA is. But to do its job, mRNA in a eukaryotic cell needs to get out into the cytoplasm where the ribosomes are. So it has to be able to get through that nuclear envelope. And it's a pretty big molecule, an mRNA. So it doesn't go directly through the phospholipid bilayer. Instead, it goes through little holes that are in the membrane. All right. Now to 8. Here we have a close-up of a ribosome that were just brown dots in previous pictures. You see a little bit more detail. Still a cartoon, of course. And also, it's actually a lie, what you're seeing here. It is true that a ribosome is a two-part thing. There are two subunits called ribosomal subunits that make up one ribosome, and one of them is bigger than the other, so there is the so-called large subunit and the small subunit. All of that is true. What is a lie, though, is that you don't see the two subunits together when there is nothing else present. The function of a ribosome is to it is a process called translation. Translation results in the actual building of a polypeptide one amino acid at a time. To do that, as I've said, the cell has to have explicit instructions for how to do that. The explicit instructions are in the mRNA molecule. So a ribosome that's not being used is not together like this. It's just two subunits apart, separate molecules or separate complexes. If an mRNA comes along, then the two can come together and more or less clamp the mRNA between it, where it can read the codes in the mRNA and assemble the polypeptide one amino acid at a time according to that code. Now the picture, the photomicrograph, not the cartoon, shows you two categories of ribosomes called free ribosomes and bound ribosomes. Well, structurally they are the same thing. And as a matter of fact, all ribosomes, when they come together as a complex, when the two subunits come together as a complex to form a ribosome, that always begins as a free ribosome. The reason they're called free is because they're not attached to the surface of anything. They're just in the cytosol. The fluid component of the cytoplasm is called the cytosol, short for cell solution. That's a free ribosome. So all ribosomes start out as free ribosomes. Some of those free ribosomes then become attached to the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum, for instance, in which case they're called bound ribosomes. Notice the word bound, the past tense of bind, which means to connect or tie. Same as in membrane-bound proteins, proteins that are tied to or bound to the membrane. So it's just a way of classifying them that's kind of artificial. They're really the same thing, but they're doing their job in different places, either not attached to a membrane or attached to a membrane. The ribosomes that you saw on the surface of the rough ER, by the way, which give it its roughness, those just happen to be the ribosomes that are there at the moment. That's always changing as well. They're not permanently attached there. Once they string their polypeptide into the lumen of the ER, they're going to detach, and new ones that started out as free ribosomes are going to come along and attach later and become bound ribosomes. Slide 9 shows you a close-up of the ER again. We've already looked at that, but in this figure we can see this budding off of membrane material to form vesicles. This is how membrane material gets moved around from organelle to organelle. So what did I say is the job of the rough ER? Exactly. Verbatim what I said. To modify newly made polypeptides. Once that modification is performed, then the rough ER has to ship them to the next organelle to work in the process of dealing with these polypeptides, which is the Golgi. And so it has to make a little bag out of membrane that comes from itself. And then once it's separated, it's a vesicle. And the vesicle contains the now modified proteins, which get transported to the Golgi complex. Well, we see the Golgi in detail in slide 10. And so this vesicle is blue to remind you of the fact that it came from the rough ER. But once it meets up with the membrane making up the Golgi itself, it's all the same material, and it will just coalesce. It changes into the teal color artificially, but you can see that coalescing happen right here. When it becomes part of the Golgi membrane, it will spill its contents. The purple balls here are the polypeptides that had just been modified by the rough ER. And so they are now in the lumen of the Golgi, where the Golgi determines where these proteins need to be shipped. It's receiving it at one end, but it's also a shipping center. Just like at a factory, there's usually separate lots. The trucks coming in are going in one lot. The trucks making deliveries away from the factory are leaving in a different lot. Similarly, in the Golgi. We say that the Golgi is polarized, which means it has two different ends, right? Well, those ends use the same terminology as geometric isomers. There's a cis face, which is the receiving end. That's where the vesicles are coming in, bringing things to the Golgi. And there's the trans face, which is where new vesicles budding off of the Golgi membrane are taking things away from the Golgi. And so these are not only functionally different ends, but you can tell which is which by looking at a cell. The cis face, the receiving end, is the end of the Golgi that's right up against the rough ER in that original picture I showed you. And the trans face, which is the outbox, basically, is closer to the edge of the cell, the plasma membrane, facing away from the rough ER. All right, 11. Here we have a picture of lysozymes at work. Lysosomes, I'm sorry. Lysozyme is an enzyme. In A, notice this process is labeled as phagocytosis. The phago part of that means eat. Cyte means cell, as I said. Osis means condition. So this word means the condition of cell eating. By analogy with our own macroscopic eating, basically, is what this is named for. What phagocytosis is an example of, just one example, there are other examples, is vesicular transport that I mentioned in this week's lab. Vesicular transport is transport of something into a cell or out of a cell using a vesicle to do that. Well, phagocytosis is bringing something into the cell via a vesicle. And so vesicular transport is the overall set of transport processes involving vesicles. That's the big set. You can subdivide that into two subdivisions based on the direction in which the thing being transported is transported. Incoming vesicular transport is called endocytosis. Outgoing vesicular transport is called exocytosis. Together, these two make up vesicular transport. All right. Well, phagocytosis is just one major subcategory of endocytosis, because notice this thing is being brought into the cell. So phagocytosis is one. You also have what is called pinocytosis. Phagocytosis and pinocytosis are the two types of endocytosis. Well, phagocytosis, as I just said, means cell eating. Pinocytosis means cell drinking. But they both involve the formation of a vesicle. And vesicular transport is kind of like a cheating mechanism in a way, because something is coming into the cell, or out, depending on the direction. But if vesicular transport is used, whatever is being transported into or out of the cell actually never goes through a membrane, unlike other things that come into or out of the cell through a membrane. You can see that in this brown chunk. It's outside the cell right now, right? And if the plasma membrane starts invaginating or infolding, it will start making a vesicle, which is called a food vacuole here, but vacuole and vesicle are really mean the same thing. They're just usually different sizes. Anyway, this interior of this vesicle that's forming is still technically outside the cell right now, right? But this particle can fit in there, and if it continues to invaginate, these two ends can pinch off, and now you have a vesicle inside the cell, and therefore the chunk is inside the cell, but it never went through a membrane. You see that? Similarly, for it spilling outward instead, which would be exocytosis. Okay, now, since the food vacuole, which is a vesicle, is made out of membrane, and the lysosome is made out of membrane, those two can coalesce, and that's how you now expose this food particle, which needs to be digested, to the hydrolytic enzymes that the lysosome is carrying, so that you can safely do that without destroying the cell material. And finally, just to finish this slide, the one on the right is a very similar process. It's called autophagy, though. Notice the word includes that same root as in phagocytosis, meaning eat. Auto means self, self-eating. So instead of this, the thing that's being eaten being a nutritious particle from outside, instead the cell is digesting part of itself. In this case, a mitochondrion who has seen better days, basically, is no longer working. So it's worthless as a mitochondrion, but that doesn't mean it's not made of valuable materials. It's recycling it by breaking it down into the monomers, which can then be rearranged in a different way to build brand new stuff. All right, pretty much out of time.